Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
It's Thanksgiving weekend and time to discuss what we're thankful for, from potatoes to potatoes. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent at The Nation magazine and MSNBC analyst. And our special guest is Leon Krause, news anchor for Univision's Los Angeles affiliate, KMEX. Welcome to all of you. So it's Thanksgiving weekend, if we're still allowed to call it that. Last week I was at Whole Foods and they were selling seasonally decorated cakes with Happy Harvest written on top, which I suppose means the war on Christmas is being supplemented with a war on Thanksgiving. But regardless, we thought we'd take the opportunity here at Left, Right, and Center to sit around our Thanksgiving table and discuss what we're grateful for this year. And I think despite all the difficult news in the world, we found some bright spots. So Rich, let's start with you. What are you thankful for this year?
Modern medicine, which is a subcategory of modern economic development that's made it possible for us to live longer lives and greater comfort than would have been imaginable through most of human history, which is basically a flat line of misery from the beginning until about the 1800s when you had the Industrial Revolution. And if you saw a doctor basically prior to sometime in the 20th century, all they would do is torture you and make you sicker. If you read what happened to George Washington, for instance, when he got his throat infection at the end of his life, it is horrifying what the doctors did to him. And finally, he said, just let me be in peace. And many medical procedures might be very uncomfortable today, but actually doctors help us. Modern dentistry, thinking of George Washington's a great folk story about his wooden teeth. Every one of those wooden teeth was a little act of misery, having had a tooth pulled or rotting or just unimaginable discomforts that we used to experience that are now mostly disappeared.
It's funny. I think this is an interesting item because this is an enormous improvement in the human condition around the world, especially over the last 100 years. But it's also at the center of our political debates and all these questions about who will get access to what medical care and who's going to pay for it. And we've also had this divergence over the last few decades. There was that study that got a lot of attention about how death rates for middle-aged, lower-educated white people in the U.S. are actually increasing, which is basically unprecedented in modern history for a group like that to be getting in worse health. Now, a lot of that is suicides and overdoses. But we've also had this overall divergence in life expectancy. Life expectancies are rising. They're rising for most groups. But they are rising much faster for people with more income and more education than they are for people with lower income and lower education. So while there's a lot to be thankful for here, I feel like there's also a divide in just how much to be thankful for.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't want to be churlish about Rich's gratitude, because gratitude is good for all of us. And everything.
Don't be harsh on my gratitude.
Yeah, please. Absolutely. No, I'm not. But I mean, I think this is really at the center of our debate over healthcare is, you know, can we expand it to more people without people who have it giving up what's good about it? And, you know, you even see this in the debate now between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, where it's Hillary Clinton who's saying, well, wait a second, there's a lot about our existing system that's good. We've already kind of not revolutionized it, but disrupted it. Let's be honest, we disrupted it with the Affordable Care Act. Let's wait a while before we go to anything as simple and simple seeming as single payer, which would actually scare a lot of people, even if it was turned out to be great.
Leon, what do you make of that, of the simultaneous, you know, how great things are in medical care and yet how difficult they seem?
Well, honestly, I mean, I agree with Rich. I was thinking of modern fertility treatments. I mean, my wife and I tried to give our son Mateo a brother or sister for a number of years, and it was frustrating and very sad. And then magic happened here in LA when we moved to America, to Los Angeles. We went through this IBF treatment, and now we have not one but two brothers for Mateo. So I mean, for me, it was a godsend. I know I sound like a hopeless romantic, but again, it's the season, and I'm very grateful. And I'm afraid of pain, terrified of pain. So thank God for anesthesia.
One other thing that I find funny about this, and how people really like medical care and sort of want to, you know, if it's being, I mean, people don't like going to the doctor, but if it's, you know, if treatment is available, I feel like people want it, they want access to it. And there are certain things that have been developed over the last 100 years that have done enormous things to extend life, often very low cost, things like vaccines and antibiotics. But I feel like we're starting to see a lot of evidence that a lot of the expensive things we do now are expensive and unpleasant and not doing that much to extend life. There are certain parts of, you know, new advanced cancer treatments that we're paying enormous number of dollars per day for life expectancy increases that might be just a couple of months. And this was also, there was a study of Medicaid in Oregon where before Obamacare, Oregon had some money to expand Medicaid, but not enough for everyone they wanted to extend it to. So they sort of had this lottery. And people who got Medicaid in the lottery got more medical care. They were more likely to be treated for mental health, for depression, which has been seen as a positive effect. Although, again, that's, you know, that's showing that people were treated. It's not necessarily showing they felt better. They were not able to find proof that they had better health outcomes, that their diabetes or heart conditions were improved by it. Now, health economists and other experts say, you know, the sample, even though it was like 10,000 people, still is kind of small for picking up those effects over a couple of years. But I think it does show that, you know, while medical care is important to people and people were less likely to go into bankruptcy or have financial hardship because of their medical needs, it was really hard to pick up the big healthcare effects. And it makes me think that people actually overrate the importance of certain kinds of medical care we get. It does a lot to assuage people's nervousness, but it's not clear that all this stuff is doing a lot to actually make us healthier.
Well, I'm an enormous critic of Medicaid, but even I have a little hard time believing that that result in Oregon. And even if it's true, having a greater sense of security, and especially financial security from catastrophic medical expenses, is a really big deal. And in terms of the cost of end-of-life care and innovative cancer treatments, for instance, that give a person 3 months, it seems completely out of whack and way too expensive unless it's the 3 months of your life.
Right, or your father's or your mother's. And yes, they get to see their new grandchild. I am thankful that Rich said exactly what I was going to say. I don't know what is going on with this holiday, but
it's the Thanksgiving spirit.
Very grateful.
In that spirit, let's move on. Joan, what are you thankful for this year?
Well, I had to work hard to think of something in the public realm that I'm thankful for. I'm very thankful for my health, for my family, for my friends, all those things. It's been a really wonderful year. I'm thankful for you guys. But in the public realm, it's tougher in the shadow of the attacks on Paris and Mali, a war that looks like it's widening, a Republican primary, at least, that's, you know, ever darker, and an election coming up on the horizon that is a little bit unnerving. But I found one thing, and it is the work of the 9 nonprofit organizations, most of them religious, that work on refugee resettlement in this country. And in addition to doing an important, crucial, Herculean task, they've added to their workload advocating for the Syrian refugees specifically. And one of the things that's so great about it to me is that you have Jewish groups working to repatriate or to find homes to welcome largely Muslim refugees. You have Christian groups who are resisting Ted Cruz's call to prioritize or limit entry to Christian Syrians. It seems like they are reminding us of the meaning of this holiday where refugees looking for religious freedom came here. I'm on the left, so I'm supposed to be the one who's kind of churlish about this and says why some people call it Happy Harvest, but I'm not going to do that today because I like this is a great secular holiday and gratitude is good. But I do think that the work of these groups, I'm hoping that in the next month it can make us more ready in the public sector for another holiday where we celebrate Jewish refugees seeking a place to have their baby. So I'm grateful for those groups.
Leon, what do you make of that?
Well, Josh, I've been thinking about this whole issue for the last few weeks. I mean, the last time I was sitting here, the world was a different place because that's the day that the Paris attacks happened. We broadcasted the show probably a couple of hours before it happened, and I've been thinking about this often. I mean, ever since 9/11, America has been determined not to let the terrorists win. I mean, that's always been the narrative. And I've been asking myself, what exactly does that mean? I think that first one has to understand that terrorism is theatrical in nature. I mean, it's psychological warfare. Terrorist organizations know that they don't have the means to wage real geographical war. So how do they win? Well, by going after and occupying the territory of the collective mind. And I think that's exactly what's been going on in America recently. As a Mexican who grew up idolizing American democracy, American values, American human rights, American freedom, the current anti-refugee backlash strikes me as an unquestionable success for ISIS and those who came before it, because, I mean, Bin Laden himself said he wanted to attack American values, and it's just been, for me at least, as an outsider with sort of like a Tocquevillian admiration of the United States, it's been sad to see.
Rich, a lot of people have been making this comparison and basically saying, look, the pilgrims came here as religious refugees fleeing persecution in their own, well, actually in two different countries, in the U.S. and then in the Netherlands. And more broadly, the U.S. had a long history of extreme openness to immigration. We still have a relatively open immigration policy compared to most advanced countries in the world. But there was a long period in U.S. history where basically more or less anybody could come here. And then also a lot of people were brought here against their will. But it's the how core is this to the American ideal? And is the resistance to refugees and more broadly, the skepticism of immigration that we're seeing in American politics, is that a rejection of that American tradition?
I don't think so. There also been long periods is where we've had very low levels of immigration, so you digest the prior high levels of immigration. And for me, it doesn't make sense, kind of the obsession with 10,000 Syrian refugees, as if we don't take those 10,000 Syrian refugees, instead just take the 70,000 refugees from around the world we do every year, somehow we've betrayed our values. I don't get that at all. It's as though there are no desperate children from the South Sudan or Sudan or Afghanistan or Eritrea or any of these other countries. So the debate, for me, just much too much weight has been put on what is a very small increment of Syrian refugees. And the question is, if you really want to help these refugees, what are you going to do to help them in the countries where there are millions, in Turkey and in Jordan and Lebanon? And it seems to me the ideal scenario is you get some sort of settlement in Syria where people can actually go back. And there is precedent for this. I think about 6 million Afghan refugees actually went back after we toppled the Taliban and Afghanistan achieved a kind of relative stability. So you'd hope to achieve the same thing in Syria.
So, Joan, I actually think Rich is right that people have been oddly fixating on this, in that there's been some people who have been out there consistently saying that the U.S. should take many more refugees than we've been planning on and have been criticizing the Obama policy as not doing enough to help. But I also see a lot of people who basically thought that policy was acceptable, who are raging against the moral bankruptcy of Republicans trying to throw up roadblocks for those 10,000. And it seems to me like admitting 10,000 Syrian refugees and admitting no Syrian refugees are actually similar policies, in the sense that neither does very much about the overall humanitarian crisis in Syria. And
I guess I would turn that around, Josh, and say to Rich and to some extent you, I actually agree. So I don't know why Republicans have seized on these 10,000 refugees, most of whom are women and children, to make a stand here. But we know why some of them are doing it. We know why Donald Trump is doing it, to demonize the other, to scare the hell out of people, because that suits his political purposes. It's a symbolic number. And most Syrian refugees don't want to come here. They would like to go back to Syria, or if not, they would like to be closer to family and have a better chance of going back to Syria. So I agree, but we've chosen this number. It will help to help 10,000 people. I don't know why people are going to the barricades to stop it.
Well, let us know what you think about Thanksgiving at kcrw.com/LRC, on our Facebook page, or at our Twitter account, at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Leon is thankful for Donald Trump. No, really, that's what he says he's thankful for. He's going to explain why. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW, only at kcrw.com/store.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Joan Walsh of The Nation magazine. And Leon Krause, news anchor for Univision's Los Angeles affiliate KMEX, is also with us. So, Leon, I'm sorry I spoiled this. You are thankful for Donald Trump. Explain yourself.
No, it was a great cliffhanger, because how can you a man who's a Hispanic journalist, how can he be grateful for Trump? But I am
a Hispanic journalist at Univision.
That's exactly right, and a friend of Jorge Ramos, I might add. Well, I'm grateful as a Hispanic journalist, because Trump has given us, not only as Hispanic journalists but also as journalists in general, I think, an engaging narrative to what was before an incredibly boring Republican field. But what's most important, I think he has challenged us journalists to work on facts, something we sometimes forget. We have had to work on facts to challenge his views. But mostly I'm grateful as a member of the Hispanic community in the United States, because Trump, I think, might be remembered as the man who perhaps unwittingly brought forth a new era of political engagement among Latinos. I mean, many organizations are hoping that Trump's hateful rhetoric will end up encouraging both Hispanic voter registration and even potential turnout a year from now. Now, if that indeed happens, Josh, Trump will have removed what I think is the one big hurdle holding back the emergence of a more powerful Hispanic voice in this country. In 2012, 12 million Latinos voted out of 24 million eligible. It was a very low 48% turnout rate. This time around, the number of eligible Latinos is 28 million. So if Trump ends up driving up registration and eventually turnout, he will empower the same people he looks down on. And I think that That would be wonderful, of course, and I would be very, very grateful for that, because I think it would be a historic moment for the Hispanic community.
He certainly has produced an amusing narrative. I've gotten some great pieces out of Donald Trump. I read The Art of the Deal and wrote not one but two columns about what the book says. But so Bob Scheer was actually taking us to task a little bit for this last week. Like, is Donald Trump still funny? Like, there's something, even when he's saying terrible things, there's something sort of inescapably humorous about him that I think allows him to get away with a lot of the stuff that he's done. Like, he seems kind of like he's a scamp. But I mean, he's saying some really terrible things now, and like mm-hmm. he might be the Republican nominee, and like there has to be a point where this isn't funny anymore. And when he comes out and says, you know, thousands of them were cheering in Jersey City on 9/11, which is not true, and when he tweets that 83% of white people who are murdered by black people, which is not true, like
it's the opposite, in fact.
It's not funny. It's right. I guess it shouldn't be funny, and yet somehow I still find myself like looking at it, and those things aren't funny, but there are certain things about him that like his ability to just like be completely neutral to the truth. Like, it doesn't matter the content of what he's saying, and he can say one thing and say a different thing tomorrow, and voters normally punish politicians for that, but they don't. It's a mockery of parts of our politics that deserve mockery. But like, satires are funny because they are fiction content. A satire in the form of an actual administration governing the United States would not be so funny.
But that's what makes him interesting and in a way politically entertaining, no? I mean, I know Rich was going to say something.
Rich,
I'm not quite as grateful for Donald Trump,
I have to say. No, it's a fascinating phenomenon. Part of it is that he's entertaining and he's shameless, and at least at this point, it's been held to a different standard. You just take that one moment a couple debates ago when he's asked about something that's in his own immigration plan,
right,
and he has no idea it's there, and was finally pointed out to him after the commercial break, no, actually, it's on your website in your plan. Just like, oh, ho hum, you know, everyone moves on. Whereas if that had happened to Jeb Bush or something, would
Or Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, slinked off the stage in humiliation. Yeah. And I wrote a column about this week where I really think Trump is tapping into a deep part of the American character. It's the Jacksonian tradition, which is anti-elitist. It really finds appealing people who say they're simple solutions, who draw a kind of harsh line between the community and outsiders, and are fiercely nationalistic and belligerent. And that's why I think Trump just hasn't gone away. It's more than just being an entertaining celebrity. He's tapping into part of our national character that has been there forever and probably will be there for a very long time, for better or worse.
Joan, as a liberal, do you buy Leon's idea that, you know, Trump is going to produce a backlash that will be good for the left and that therefore liberals should be grateful for him?
I'm just not sure right now. I think he will produce a backlash. I think certainly among Latinos, you know, possibly among African Americans, because he is the birther in chief. But I guess I'm more worried about it and less thankful, partly because what we're talking about, too, is the inability of our media to really know how to handle somebody who has this, you know, neutral relationship with the truth, as you put it nicely. You know, if you really read that or listen to or watch that interview with George Stephanopoulos, I mean, on This Week on Sunday, he's on the phone. First of all, he breaks the rules. You know, he gets to phone in to all the shows and they take his calls. I mean, I've never gotten to do that. I don't know about you. And then he breaks the rules by lying. And if you read it, it's like if you read the transcript, Stephanopoulos is actually pretty good at calling out all of his lies. You know, no, Muslims did not cheer. Police officers said, no, that's been debunked. No, Obama does not want to welcome a quarter of a million Syrian refugees. No, the number is actually 10,000. But it doesn't, as he talks over it, it doesn't work. And so at a certain point, you know, you're kind of hoping for him to cut the mic or just say to the audience and to the producers, I'm sorry, but this is not the way interviews are normally conducted, and I can't do my job here.
Some of that is just the superficiality of TV in particular,
right.
As long as you're the stronger one
talking.
And the more confident one, mm-hmm. and talking over people, it almost doesn't matter what
right.
you're saying,
yeah.
unfortunately. And Trump, you know, lying is a correct word for some of this, but also has to do with just this reality distortion zone he lives in.
Right.
He lives in his private reality. I remember after the first debate, he said in one of the post-debate interviews, oh, it was so great, the other candidates came up to me and said I had won. Whenever in political history has someone done that,
right.
you know, but in his own head, it's there
it
for
happens.
Whatever reason.
So Leon, if this backlash and what you see is possibly like the biggest activation of the Hispanic vote in the U.S., what form would that take? I mean, obviously there's, you know, Trump's numbers are very unfavorable among Hispanic voters, but who becomes the vessel for that activism? Is it Hillary Clinton or sort of who?
That's,
what's the positive side of that?
You know, that's a great question. Obviously, I think the first step would be voter registration. I mean, many, many people, when you talk to a Hispanic community and when you look at the numbers, people are either afraid or for whatever reason they don't register. They could become citizens and they don't. That would be the first step. If that changes, then the second step would be turnout. I don't really care about the way people would vote, although one would expect that after what Trump has done, people will overwhelmingly vote Democratic, even more so than the last election. But eventually, I mean, my dream as an outsider, as a man who has always loved the United States but who is not a citizen, I hope eventually I will be, but I wasn't born here. I would love to see the emergence of a new generation of Hispanic political leaders, and I think that next generation will have to come from the millennial generation. I've spoken to many kids, high school kids recently, who feel very strongly about what Trump has done. That would be the dream. That this is the moment a group of kids decided to enter public life and change that dynamic that's a sad dynamic in the Hispanic community. We really lack real political leaders.
Well, at the moment, the new generation of Latino leaders is running in the Republican
that's right.
nomination race and doing
You're absolutely
quite well.
Correct. You're absolutely correct. Yeah. I wouldn't care if they were Republicans. I would really want them to show themselves and to get involved in public life. You know, Rich, it just doesn't happen, and it's sad because then it's just not they are not empowered.
Well, so and then here's an interesting segue. Donald Trump also has to do with the thing I'm grateful for. I'm not grateful for Donald Trump, but I am grateful for consumer culture, which is something that sort of people knock a lot and they complain about conservatism. But some of the most interesting pieces I've written this year for The New York Times have been about companies that have super fans. I wrote one about SoulCycle. SoulCycle has a 23% profit margin. They're going public. And the question is, like, why do people pay $35 for a spin class, and how come competitors can't just come in and take all that market share. And you talk to these people and they basically tell you, oh, well, it's not just a workout. It's a spiritual experience. And I just, you know, I can't feel as good as I do when I go to that class. Those are my 45 minutes. and so it's, you know, that is something that's making people really happy. And then similarly, I wrote a piece about the merger between Starwood Hotels and Marriott, which was announced last week. And people who stay in Starwood Hotels all the time are freaking out. I talked to people who said things to me like, I'm frightened about what this merger means for me. You talk to these people who stay over 100 nights a year with the same hotel chain. And like at Starwood, they get their own personal ambassador. And that's who they call whenever they have a booking to make. On one level, this stuff is really stupid. And it can make these consumers sort of monsters and over-entitled. This one guy told me that he was upset that they didn't call him in advance and tell him about the merger before they announced it to the press.
Concierge should have done that,
right? But on the other hand, like, there's something wonderful about the fact that our economy can produce products that not only meet consumer needs but that delight people. And even when you look at one sector and say it's ridiculous to have such a strong emotional opinion about a hotel or about the way you work out, you probably have some other product that you have a weird emotional connection to. Like, there are these things that people have emotional connections with that I think they get value out of beyond the fact that it's just a product. And I actually think that's a wonderful thing about our modern times, even if it causes people to be very silly some of the time.
Rich and I are looking at each other like, should we come at him from the left or the right about this soulless consumer culture?
Well, but that's the thing. I don't think it's necessarily soulless. Yeah. I mean, it's like, no. On the one hand, and we got a letter about the Starwood thing that's basically like, this is why you should never love a corporation, because a corporation can never love you back. And it's like, that's true, but the corporation can act like it loves you for a good long time. And like, sometimes loving another human being gets you into a lot of trouble.
I think the one positive thing that I will grant you is I think the companies that really pay a lot of attention to customer service do very well, and companies that understand that it's kind of a relationship. These transactions at their best are relationships, and making people feel good can be a great value. Of course, there's all this writing about, you know, the forced culture of caring where these low-paid people are supposed to act like they're your best friends and you know, and they're not compensated for it. But I'm going to grant you that in the spirit of the holiday. And
well, that's the genius of our system, is none of these people care about you whatsoever, but through the profit motive, they pretend. And it feels really good. And just the amazing consumer bounty. My wife is a very persnickety shopper, so we're Whole Foods people. And sometimes I think back, there was this famous kitchen debate between Richard Nixon and the Soviet Premier Khrushchev when he came over here and saw an exhibit of what was supposed to be a typical middle American household. And it had all sorts of luxury consumer goods, or what would have been considered luxury consumer goods in the Soviet Union, they just couldn't believe. And I just sometimes think of him walking the aisles of Whole Foods with this incredible variety. And it's not even average, in a variety of average stuff. It's a variety of all these incredibly exotic brands. And that, again, just goes to the incredible fruits of the system. Now, it's not ultimately spiritually fulfilling, and it has all sorts of downsides. But we live in an age of kind of everyday miracles.
Leon, is this something we should be thankful for?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm grateful for American consumer culture. I'll give you a quick example from my childhood. When I was growing up in Mexico, we didn't have American chocolates, no M&Ms, no Milky Way, no Kit Kat. We had great Mexican chocolate, but not the candy bars we really craved. So my parents actually had this black market dealer, I'm really not kidding, for American Hershey's. So you can imagine how grateful I am for my convenience store right on the corner. And one more extreme example, when we came to California, my wife fell in love with alkaline water. She makes me spend $50 a month on alkaline water. And I know I should probably draw the line on whether my water is alkaline or not, but I mean, I just can't do that. First, because
can you taste the difference?
Absolutely not. But I give in, first, because I'm afraid of my wife, very afraid, and second, because I feel very healthy. I mean, it turns out an alkaline man really is a better man.
Well, there you have it. We can be thankful for our alkalinity this Thanksgiving. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Joan Walsh, and Leon Krause. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Hannah Tayson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.